Un po' di fitta, un po' da adegliani.
That's the mantra for arousing bodhicitta, part of the Gate of Sweet Dew. After we feed the hungry ghosts, all the distraught spirits throughout the universe, they're all well fed and dancing around happily, and then we say, wait, before you go, there's one more thing. We really want you to have this precious mind of awakening. It will help you and all beings in wonderful ways beyond your imagination. Bodhicitta. Sometimes said to have these two aspects, the wish that all beings be free from suffering, and the aspiration, intention to realize complete awakening in order to help all beings realize this freedom. So I think it's important to see these two sides, because sometimes we think it's just total compassion. It's just this deep, heartfelt wish that all beings be free from suffering. Isn't that bodhicitta? Well, it is an essential ingredient, but it's half. The other half is, in order to bring this about, I will realize this awakening. I'd say, well, can't we just help all beings be free from suffering without being a Buddha? And seems that actually, no. I don't think we can, because part of it is understanding what suffering is, right? So we can help in all kinds of practical ways. We can be a doctor, a multi skilled doctor who can be, a surgeon and a diagnosis person, and all kinds of, ways we could maybe physically, if we're a really skilled doctor, physically help all physical ailments. But when we see actually you can do that and still beings are suffering, well, maybe we can be a psychotherapist and a doctor. But in the end, it's like the only way to really be free from suffering is to actually have deep wisdom and understanding as well as compassion. Because going back to the Buddha's very first teaching, the definition, what is this suffering? What is this dukkha? It's grasping. It's a mental holding on to all kinds of subtle views, ideas, maybe at the subtlest level we could say just grasping the external world as external to us, or as a kind of independent, as a world of independent entities. That's a kind of grasping. You could say, well, even psychotherapists can't quite get at that one, not to mention medical doctors. So, but Buddhas understand how that works, and so they maybe have a chance to help others let go of those final subtle roots of grasping and be completely free, become Buddhas themselves and help others. So this is the reason why bodhicitta involves not only the wish, deep heartfelt wish, all beings really be free from all suffering, but as a means to personally put that into effect, we need to have the realization of a Buddha and the skillful means of a Buddha, which comes from this realization of deep wisdom. From that is born the infinite skillful means, which is like how each sentient being will become free and see clearly what each one needs differently. So this vast skillful means and vast subtle wisdom of a Buddha we need. But the only reason we need it is to help all beings be free from suffering. That's what makes the bodhicitta this very compassionate, non-self-centered aspiration. One early place, this is this bodhicitta is first taught, is in the Prajnaparamita Sutras. Right, these bodhicittas first taught in the Mahayana Sutras, and Prajnaparamita is like the first revealing of these. This vast scope of this bodhisattva vehicle in the world. So the Diamond Sutra is one of them, one of the early Mahayana sutras. So this is one of the classic statements, I think very concise definition. It doesn't use the word bodhicitta actually, but I think this is what a good definition of it. Sabuti is asking the Buddha, the Blessed One, how should a bodhisattva practice in the great vehicle? And the Blessed One, the Buddha, said, "Here, Sabuti, someone who has set out in the vehicle of a bodhisattva, the bodhisattva-yana, also called the Mahayana, should produce a thought in this manner." Sometimes we think, well, shouldn't a bodhisattva think of not thinking? And, you know, Dogen will tell us that even in his bodhicitta essay. But in this case, a bodhisattva should produce a thought. That's right. Bodhisattvas should give rise to a thought. And this is this word, cittodpada. So some bodhicittodpada is arousing or generating the thought of awakening. So hotsu is the Japanese way of saying utpada. So give rise to or generate. So there's a Sanskrit term, bodhicit utpada, means to generate or give rise to the mind or thought of awakening. And in Japanese we say that hotsu bodaishin, or Hotsu Mujo Shin. So these essays of Dogen are like, we could translate into Sanskrit as bodhicittutpada. So in this case, a bodhisattva should produce the thought, cittutpada, in this manner, this kind of a thought, quote, this is the thought, "As many beings as there are in the universe of beings, comprehended under the term beings," just to be really clear, almost like a legalistic sort of language, right? We're just making sure we cover all the bases. "All these beings comprehended under the term beings, which include egg-born, womb-born, moisture-born, or miraculously born." So these are these, you know, this is just the way these Indian Buddhists think about things extensively, right? All the ways that beings could be born. So we actually are talking about sentient beings here. We're talking about beings that are born. So in this case, it doesn't include rocks, which are not born in one of these ways. Egg-borne, you know, is pretty clear. Doesn't include that. In this case, it was their Indian understanding of what sentient means. So, you know, born from eggs, a lot of animals we know, born from womb, a lot of animals and humans, moisture-borne in the commentaries makes it clear that it's like insects that are born from warm humidity.
Mosquitoes.
Mosquitoes, yeah. I think Edward Conze said worms too, so I don't know about that, how worms are born, but maybe small ones. Well, there you go, yeah. They didn't, I think. This is about maybe 100 BC. So it's pretty good for that time period. They're thinking about these things. But we could say the world of insects. And miraculously or spontaneously born, and I didn't know this till I saw this commentary, that this refers to these, like, for example, hell beings who, like the story of those, that fiery place where the guards are pushing the bodhisattva to keep pulling that heavy cart, that apparently, this is Buddhist cosmology, right, about hell realms and heavenly realms too, is that beings are not like, it's not like there's parents that give birth to beings in these realms like hell. Maybe that would be too happy for a hell realm to give birth in that way. So I kind of have this new clarity about how they're maybe not babies in hell realms. Right? You're born like as an adult. And if we take this metaphorically, I think, you know, maybe there are some babies in hell realms, but I think that usually hell comes from extreme anger and resistance. And maybe very young babies maybe don't have that in such a way that adults do to create hell realms. I don't know, I'm sort of extrapolating. It could be that what looks like humans in our human world, there could be what look to us as humans, but actually they're hell beings, maybe. You know, it depends how literally we take these things. Some people, because these are all mind states, so somebody could be like, feel like they're, and we might have felt this way sometimes, like we're actually have left the human realm. Our suffering is so extreme. We're just raging with, we're just, you know, suicidal type of mind, right? It could be like, we've forgotten that we're human. I think this could happen, right? We're so down. It's like we say a living hell, right? So, in that case, maybe a little different. I think when I heard this, that hell beings are spontaneously born as, you know, with all their limbs and everything. And also there's stories that their lifespans are really long and they don't necessarily get old. It's like almost like these timeless periods, even though they do come to an end. I just thought that was interesting, that partly because we're talking about the Buddha is covering the bases here of all these kinds of birth, and we could say it just means the six realms. We're not just talking about humans and animals, we're talking about invisible realms of beings, but they're called sentient beings, right? And also, like if there's a bardo in between lives, they would also be kind of spontaneously born. It's not like bardo beings are born from a womb. Maybe they're born from a tunnel of light or something, but anyway, it's a little bit sidetracked, but I just, interesting to think about these different realms. Again, a bodhisattva should produce a thought in this manner. As many beings as there are in the universe of beings, comprehended under the term beings, born in these four ways, with or without form, with perception, without perception, and with neither perception nor non-perception, And this is referring to some like deva realms, is one of the six realms too. There's beings that have no, there's formless heavens, for example. It's just covering all the possible realms of sentient beings. As far as any conceivable form of beings is conceived, all these I must lead to nirvana, into that realm of nirvana which leaves nothing behind, leaves no traces of suffering or dis-ease behind. And yet, the thought goes on, and yet, although innumerable beings have thus been led to nirvana by me, no being at all has been led to nirvana. And why? If in a bodhisattva the notion of a being should take place, he could not be called a bodhi being, a bodhisattva. And why? He is not to be called a bodhisattva in whom the notion of a self or of a being should take place, or the notion of a living soul or of a person. So this is a definition of the thought of enlightenment that a bodhisattva gives rise to, generates. All beings I must lead to nirvana, which we could say means perfect peace and freedom from all suffering, freedom from greed, hate, and delusion, and in a sustained way, where because it's an unconditioned nirvana, it's not a happiness that depends on certain conditions. So I vow to lead, it says. I must lead them to nirvana. How we do that could be a long discussion, but that's the wish. Before I even decide how, I just really want to. You can tell me how later, after I make the vow. However I need to, I vow to lead them there. And at the same time, I have to see that there aren't any beings to lead there. So that's this bodhicitta, which is this great compassion, infinite, boundless, impartial compassion, non-discriminating compassion, because equally I will lead them all, and the wisdom to see that there aren't any beings, the wisdom of emptiness. So I think it's a beautiful expression that really includes the entire thought of awakening. And you might see, well, it seems totally contradictory. How could you have this strong wish to save these beings when there aren't any beings? And that is the beauty of the bodhisattva path. The awesome, inconceivable beauty is it's inconceivable. And yet, this is the story, is that we can have this wish really, conceiving of beings, it's talking about any conceivable form of beings. We conceive of these beings like you and me and all of us, including the insects and these hungry ghosts and all of them that we're conceiving of. If we can conceive of them, we wish to free them all completely. And we see that our conceptions of them are just that, actually they're not who we think they are. That's the wisdom that makes it possible. And maybe that's what we think. Well, beings are numberless, so I have to save them one at a time like this, and there's no end. But if actually there aren't any beings, then maybe it seems, whatever that means, right, that there aren't really any actual, inherently existent beings, then maybe it becomes a little more workable. Maybe we see that our limited idea of numberless is could be a sticking point.
I think that gets you off the hook.
Well, it depends. If we don't, we have to have this compassionate part, right?
I mean, what about it's endless and you just do it, and it's impossible, but you do it.
Well, that's how it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I mean,
but we can.
But we don't have to
It's inconceivable, but it may be that I say that if we feel like, we may feel like it's too overwhelming, I'm not even going to think about it, then something about this emptiness teaching, it doesn't, I don't think it actually gets us off the hook. In fact, it puts us on a bigger hook. It puts us on the hook of having to realize emptiness completely, which is actually quite a bit harder than just like putting lots of band-aids on lots of beings. That, which is an interesting point because it might seem easier, right? And I think this is a danger of these emptiness teachings, right? Might be like, well, I don't really have to do anything because they aren't really there.
But you still have to put on band-aids. If you
do, maybe band-aids.
You don't have to, but I mean, there are beings that band-aids would be the appropriate response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
But you're not saving them, like, mm-hmm.
And band-aids is not enough. So we do need band-aids, but it's not the whole story, because if we're putting on band-aids and big band-aids and helping in all kinds of ways, but we still think that there actually are beings, that wouldn't accord completely with this bodhicitta, as I understand it here, right? Because the Buddha's saying you have this wish to save them all, lead them all to nirvana, and yet no being at all has been led to nirvana. The bodhisattva has to see that also. So it's a subtle, tricky thing, because it could easily slip into a kind of nihilistic view of emptiness, right? Where they don't even have to bother doing anything because there isn't anybody. So that's this amazing, inconceivable Mahayana spirit is, they really are empty, but we have to really clarify what empty means. And it doesn't undermine, many times it's said, if the view of emptiness starts to undermine compassion, means like, well, it doesn't really matter because there really aren't any beings, then immediately give up meditating on emptiness, because it should actually not ever undermine compassion. So that's part of what's going on here, and the subtlety is that when this is working correctly, the compassion keeps growing and growing, and all kinds of ways to help keep growing, and the wisdom keeps deepening also, and they're not contradictory, although they seem contradictory when we first hear it. So, yeah, it doesn't mean that we don't put on lots of band-aids, but it's not just a matter of putting on a bunch of band-aids. Yes.
Is it that we're supposed to, as we inevitably do, operate with ordinary mind as well as our understanding?
Yeah, I mean, ordinary mind here is kind of like, we have to be careful when we use that term, because in Zen and Mahayana Buddhism, sometimes ordinary mind is used for enlightened mind. Ordinary meaning like this very plain, empty, clear basis for all our extraordinary, crazy thoughts. Sometimes ordinary minds use that way. But if we're using it to mean like our kind of like just ongoing, deluded kind of belief in inherent existence mind, that kind of mind, then, I think as long as we have that kind of mind, we use it to benefit beings.
I think about people I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it seems. Mm-hmm. I think they also have this more ordinary way of thinking about suffering.
Yeah, well, they accord with sentient beings. They, because that's how they help. Even a Buddha, a fully awakened Buddha, like Shakyamuni Buddha, still like talks in the language of the place he lives, and has a body that lives for 80 years, and eats food and walks around and gets sick and stuff like that. So, we could say, in order to accord with living beings so that he can meet living beings in the, where they're at. So it's kind of a skillful means to manifest the body for our sake, as one of our chants says. So you could say, for a great realized, really enlightened bodhisattva, it's like they're still operating in the conventional world, but they also don't believe it as strongly as we do. And you could say they believe it just enough to operate, stay in it, because that's their vow. If they completely dropped off any belief in it at all, they would enter nirvana before us, and their vow is not to do that. So they're holding enough projection of a world and suffering beings to help, because that's their compassionate vow. Maybe that still sounds a little bit exalted. So we could talk about bodhisattvas in different ways. And that's one of them. You know, there's aspiring bodhisattvas who still really believe in the solidity of this world, like maybe you and I do. And I aspire to be a bodhisattva, and, you know, maybe strictly speaking, with some of these definitions, I'm not quite there, but I have this deep wish to be willing to go there, to be a bodhisattva. So it depends how we define it, right? This reminds me of one of our great bodhisattvas of our times, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Says a little bit about this, and a little bit about himself. That's why I wanted to bring this up. First, he says there are two ways to develop a deep sense of empathy toward a person who's suffering. Empathy or compassion. The first depends on seeing all sentient beings as extremely close and dear. We think about the individuals who've been the kindest to us in this life. It could be our parents or very possibly our mother. We appreciate the depths of kindness this person has shown us, and then consider that all limitless sentient beings are as kind as this one person. So it's a kind of intentional training to see the kindness of everybody. On the basis of seeing everyone as dear and close to us, empathy is developed to the extent that we cannot bear others to suffer. So this is one way to develop compassion or empathy, is to see all beings as very close and dear and having benefited us in many ways. It's hard to do, right, sometimes. There's one way, and a lot could be said about that in the future. But the second way to develop this empathy is to reflect on and compare the damaging effects of a constantly self-centered view with the benefits of continually having the welfare of others at heart, even cherishing them more than ourselves. This is just kind of being practical and seeing, oh, and actually in my own life I can see when I'm more self-centered, it's not very happy, there's not many benefits to me or anybody else. And when I have this compassionate attitude, it seems that actually I feel better, and so do others. So we just kind of remind ourselves of this obvious truth that we don't really need to be convinced of. This point is made concisely in Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva, in the well-known verse, "Whatever happiness there is in this world, all comes from desiring others to be happy. And whatever suffering there is in this world, all comes from desiring oneself to be happy." This is a radical verse. We can see that happiness comes from desiring others to be happy, but he really takes it pretty far and says all happiness actually comes from this wish for others to be happy. And all suffering comes from desiring myself to be happy. We might say that's a little extreme, but it's, I like how it kind of like pokes my sense of reality a little bit, right? And we might check it out for ourselves. If we're suffering, if we're suffering at any given time, might happen during this very sesshin. See if behind that suffering is the desire for me to be happy. And we might say, well, can we turn that to wanting others to be happy and be relieved? We could experiment with that. This bodhicitta is of extraordinary and crucial importance. Don't you find it truly moving the more you think about it? We should say to ourselves, I don't know if this is the Dalai Lama coming up with these verses, but he says, we should say, while I live, or we should generate a thought like this, maybe we could say, while I live, I will meditate on bodhicitta. This is what will give meaning to my life. At the moment of death, I will meditate on bodhicitta. It will help me to continue onward on my way toward enlightenment. When I'm thriving and happy, I will meditate on bodhicitta. It will enable me to use my prosperity to serve others and avoid the pitfalls of pride, envy, and lack of respect. When I face failure and sadness, I will meditate on bodhicitta. It will prevent me from losing heart and losing hope. So, all the time and in any situation, in life, when death is near, in success or failure, in joy or sorrow, bodhicitta is something I cannot be without. And then he says, and this is a part I came across today and found quite startling, because I think in the Tibetan world, people maybe think of, if there's one great bodhisattva alive on this earth, it may be the Dalai Lama, and he said to be a living incarnation of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, right? So he goes on to say, I would like to make it clear at this point that I do not have bodhicitta in my heart to any extent at all. I felt a little bit relieved about this, because as I confessed yesterday, I'm like, I'm kind of working with whether I actually am up for this bodhicitta thing or not. I think some people were trying to convince me. Oh, no, it's okay. we can do it. But here's this person whose tradition is like almost based on bodhicitta. He's thinking about it for 60 years or something, doing all these practices to generate it. I would like to make it clear at this point that I do not have bodhicitta in my heart to any extent at all. It may seem as though I do, because of my familiarity with the subject, but I do not. I certainly try to have bodhicitta. I hope to have it, and that hope is not an entirely empty one. Yet it's still just a hope. I hope that I may become able to arouse true bodhicitta, but I do not experience it now. Nevertheless, even to have the inspiration to develop bodhicitta changes your mind, doesn't it? I think, yes, it does. So, what a humble being. Is he just saying this to so we don't feel too discouraged? Or is it there something that's like totally so awesome about this bodhicitta that someone who makes it his life's work to generate it feels like he hasn't yet done this? So it's interesting, you know, because we can water it down, make it easier to swallow and practice, or we can evaporate it, condense it into an even more solid, congealed form where it's like impossible. We can not get attached to either. Condensing it or watering it down. And I think Dogen is pretty good at like not falling into either. of those extremes. But that was surprising to me. Also, we speak of the loving or caring element in compassion and say great loving compassion. This means that love must begin with oneself and then be extended to others. So he, how so? Yeah, yeah. So I think that's why he's saying this, right? He's saying, desiring myself to be happy is the cause of all suffering. So I think this is a little different to say just loving oneself, which we might say is accepting oneself completely as one is a little bit. What's that? But it's not so much desiring happiness. Yeah. So maybe that would be a distinction. Is it's just, it's not, saying trying to do something to accrue it might be like trying to, desiring happiness, but maybe this is like a natural love for ourself. And maybe we could say not even the small self, but like getting in touch with our Buddha nature where there is more self-acceptance. He says, some people may get the wrong impression and think that compassion is exclusively directed outwardly toward others and does not concern us at all. So I think he's just, because of that verse of Shantideva, he's saying, compassion, some people feel, does not bring us any benefit at all. In fact, it's more like a tax being levied on us, or a heavy burden loaded onto our backs that's going to overwhelm us. This seems to be a quite common feeling. So that's partly what I was expressing. It's too much. But, yeah, it could be guilt factor too. Mm-hmm. But this is a complete mistake, he says. Think about it carefully. Look at your own experience. Once you get used to feeling compassion in your heart, as each day goes by, you'll naturally feel a growing courage and determination. When you think about the welfare of others, it makes your mind broader and more expansive. Also, when you've discovered that kind of courage, you can shoulder responsibility for the welfare of others. In no way, then, does it seem like a tax or something that the Buddha is imposing on you, a Buddha tax. Because you can see and feel the benefits of altruism here and now for yourself as well as others. So I think this is part of it, is that we generate the wish to benefit others, but it helps us. Which goes back a little bit to like the discussion about the shepherd versus the king. From a kind of usual self-centered point of view, at least I might sometimes think, I'd like to do the king way because I like can't stand suffering any longer. And then I really do want to help others, but let's do this first for me. Whereas the shepherd way is like, I want to help all others first before me. If we really have that spirit, that really selfless, compassionate spirit, of course that helps us. Because the shepherd is totally joyful to feel that way. It's a little scary to think about it from the self-centered point of view. I'm like, I don't know about this shepherd thing. But I think if we're actually in the mind of the shepherd, it's a very happy, free from self-concern state of mind.
Okay. So I'll contend that in order to get that shepherd point of view,
mm-hmm.
I don't like this term king. Because how I'm thinking of having a merciful and compassionate view and understanding of oneself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that in fact is a meditation of Vedanta, and you know, meditation turning mercy into times that I've tried, it's been extremely difficult, you know.
Yeah.
Mercy on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I have mercy on anybody else.
Yeah, sometimes harder.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm
intending that the reason that's so important
Yeah.
So you're clear.
Yeah.
You're shepherding from anger or from insanity that you were talking about, but I was relating so much to that, like the second step of our involvement in Zen, the first one curiosity.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, if we haven't cleared that up, done this work, I mean, I don't know if it's endless work or what. That's the real question for me, where's the work? But if we haven't done it, you know, if we're looking inward, sitting, being in nature, doing all these practices.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I appreciate that. So one way that's coming to mind as you say that is maybe it's just a matter of degree or extent, because I think we do need that, and that's what the Dalai Lama is saying too. We need self-love first. So we could say the shepherd needs to be have some basic well-being, or he's not going to actually be nice to the sheep anyway. So it's a matter of how far you want to go, and that's why I think the term king in these examples is kind of nice, because it pushes that going all the way to complete perfect enlightenment, that kind of regal king of enlightenment before maybe even really, I don't know if we say even starting to help others, because in order to become the king, you actually have to have a lot of compassion too. But I think the shepherd, they're not so clear cut, right? So the shepherds actually have some degree of enlightenment, but they're saying they maybe don't have the complete full thing. They maybe get pretty far along and they say, before I go all the way with this, I'm going to tend the sheep.
Well, that's what Kathy was saying, isn't it? She was saying, well, while we're here, you know, we can't wait to get enlightened. We need to be putting band-aids.
Yeah.
I don't think it comes with band-aids, you know. I mean, we need to do everything our best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the interesting context of it is, and the greatest part of it is that we're doing it in impossible and ununderstandable circumstances.
We still do it.
I'm still as upright and as useful and helpful.
Yeah.
Salving a lot.
Mm-hmm. Like filling a well with snow wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
Which will never be possible to fill. So then we also have like the middle, in a way, sort of like a middle way between the king and the shepherd is the ferry pilot, the boat pilot, right? Where it's like, it's not that I'm going first, it's not that they're going first, but we all are going together. And I'm working on it, on getting across this river, and along with everybody else, without making any distinction. So it's kind of nice, I think, that one. It's just interesting to examine our own motivations, which are maybe changing between these three types of bodhicitta and no bodhicitta throughout the day. We might also say, you know, if the Dalai Lama is saying, I don't have any bodhicitta, we could also think of it as like the aspiration for the aspiration that we call bodhicitta.
This is what's occurring. We're talking about an idea of bodhicitta. Let's compare that, or let me ask you to compare that to just the idea of awareness. In other words, I'm going to try and give you an image, my Zen image that I think I got from this book, Power, is awareness suspended between emptiness and the impossible, ready to respond spontaneously wherever it arrives. Okay, that's awareness. But that doesn't have any, it's ready to respond spontaneously wherever it arrives. So there's almost no issue or discussion about bodhicitta in there.
Yeah.
We've gotten rid of our insanity somehow through our practice. We've settled down. We've got out of this thinking web. You know, now we have ordinary mind, or we're starting to have it. You know.
So your awareness that you talk of there sounds maybe something more like this ultimate bodhicitta that actually is like just Buddha mind, empty and ready.
Empty and ready.
Yeah, yeah. kind of like ultimate bodhicitta. And so we could say that we also, in a way, we have that. If we look at it from a kind of Buddha nature perspective, we already have it. And to fully reveal it and manifest it in the world, we also want the relative conventional bodhicitta. Again, it's these two truths. It's like that mind is almost like the mind that sees there aren't any beings to save. And we can join that with, we're going to save all these beings, these different particular types of beings. We're making all these distinctions.
But out of that, out of just awareness, if we could cultivate that, which I think Zen is best might be, or what Zen practice is, cultivating awareness. Yeah. The picture I have is out of that awareness grows all these things.
I see. So,
wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Almost from that revealing the empty clarity of Buddha nature, compassion is a natural quality of that. It is actually taught. And that you know, by, we might even say, just sitting, our natural bodhicitta emerges from that. So I think something like that is kind of like pretty close to Dogen's perspective when we get into Dogen's talking about this. And, you know, Some may say, well, it's not necessarily the case. I mean, there are these teachings where there's like these different vehicles, right? Like the Shravaka vehicle has compassion. In this view, they realize some emptiness, but with maybe without great compassion, some compassion, but not the great compassion that wishes to save all beings. And therefore, bodhicitta is not fully manifest for a Shravaka. That's what the part of the story here. Now, in a discussion somewhat like this one time with my teacher, I think I said something. He was saying, well, what about, do you have this wish or something like that? We were talking about, do you have this bodhicitta wish? And I think we're saying maybe something like you, I feel like actually, maybe I was arguing for the Shravakas, saying how could Shravakas actually not have this wish, or not have this compassionate spirit completely, if they see how the nature of mind, and he says something like, well, it's like you have. You saying that kind of shows that you have a kind of bodhisattva spirit, that you think that all beings, including Shravakas, would have this natural bodhicitta. You could see the compassionate wish in a Shravaka, but, you know, not everybody might think that. I mean, the tradition doesn't... Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain kinds of clarity and realization of emptiness that might not be conjoined with compassion. And I think we can see examples of this in the Zen world. There's various scandals and things going on, right? And I think some of these teachers have some really deep insight into non-substantiality and emptiness. And I think that partly because when people keep telling them about their... could they work on their problems a little bit? They're not very responsive, and they're just, I don't think I have a problem, or something like that. But I think they're not suffering very much, but they seem to be acting in ways that aren't so skillful and are actually harming beings. So I think that's an example of it's possible to have some quite deep insight into, maybe we say it's not actually shunyata, it's not really emptiness, it's a slightly skewed version of it. Something like that without generating this great compassion. It's sort of like what we call nihilism, right? One might fall into a nihilistic slant on emptiness. So that's why the bodhicitta teachings are so, I think, so beneficial, because they're saying, as what you do want to realize emptiness completely, and you want to keep generating in the conventional world this great compassionate wish, And you maybe do it like intentionally. I mean, the Buddha is saying to Sabuti, who is a great wise practitioner, is saying, you should generate a thought like this. Instead of saying, well, if you just sit quietly, naturally this thought will arise. In this sutra, he's saying, he's not saying that, right? He's saying, if you want to be a bodhisattva, you should produce, arouse, generate, give rise to this thought, which sounds like something that you intentionally do. Yeah. Yeah, it's an intentional. And again, that's the relationship between the relative and the ultimate bodhicitta. You could say the relative is in the world where we have intentions. Let's have that intention. And at some point, we may be a Buddha where we no longer have any personal intentions, but all our actions are just pure responsiveness to beings. Like it's no longer... That's one story about a Buddha, is that they no longer have what we think of as an intention. Everything is beneficial to beings, but it's just natural response. Yeah, like you were saying. Yeah, yeah. So we're training. There's bodhicitta training, our effort for our, you know, intentional practice to realize non-intentional perfect response. Yeah, we could say it like that. Yes, Larry. Bowing? Bowing. Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's never abandoning beings, right? Well, we'll get to this, right? We'll go through the whole essay. But I think it's not so prevalent in this particular essay. It's not so prevalent. I think we can probably find it. But that's why, and maybe that's why he wrote another one. And so in the other one that we will also study this year, Hotsu Bodaijin, that's the one where he really pushes others first, and it's more compassionate. Yeah, this one does emphasize renunciation and the mind of freedom. And let's see as we get into it if we can find compassion. But I think part of the story is that the Zen tradition doesn't put as much emphasis on compassion as, for example, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. I think Dogen's Hotsu Bodaijin is one of the places where Dogen, you really feel Dogen's great compassionate heart shining through that essay, maybe less so in this one. But bodhicitta traditionally has, well, as you heard in the Diamond Sutra, it's this, you know, this wish to be, maybe Zen falls more into the side of the wish for complete enlightenment, and with a little in parentheses, to benefit all beings. And then the Tibetans maybe emphasize more like the wish to benefit all beings, in parentheses, and you must realize enlightenment. So there's different emphases, but I think it's good. That's why at the beginning I said, brought up these two points that we want to cultivate both of them, and in our own individual practice, we can see maybe we have a tendency, like maybe you're saying you have a tendency more towards the enlightenment side and not so much the compassionate side. Some people, I think, are drawn to this practice really just out of compassion, and they really like, I really am not so into like zazen and stuff like this, but I love like just being able to help. So I think, and it might go back and forth year to year, day to day. So I think these two sides is nice to keep in mind, and like, let's emphasize both. And if we start falling, you know, overemphasizing one at the expense of the other, then cultivate the other. So sesshin is a time when we're, maybe it's more about the becoming, realizing awakening, because we're doing a lot of sitting. But we also see in sesshin, we have all these wonderful forms to help others. Kind of simple maybe, but like just how we serve each other food and things like this, and how we interact. There's not that much interaction, but there's enough we can really notice how we're, can we do this in the spirit of kindness and love, but also with the sense of the suffering of others, how do we respond? So, yeah, these are all good points. Here's a Zen saying, a little teaching about bodhicitta from Muso Soseki. A little bit, actually was born like 20 years after Dogen died, so around Dogen's time in Japan. Rinzai Zen teacher. He says, among practitioners who arouse the mind of awakening as a bodhisattva, there is a difference between those who excel in wisdom and who excel in compassion. This is kind of about your point. Sorry. One who vows to first save all beings before himself attains the Buddha way as a bodhisattva who excels in compassion. This is, I think, I would say kind of like the shepherd view. One who intends to attain the Buddha way himself first in order to save all beings afterward is a bodhisattva who excels in wisdom. This is more like the king way. But here he's talking about the emphasis is on wisdom versus compassion. The aspiration of a bodhisattva who excels in wisdom bears some resemblance to the aspiration of shravakas and pratyeka buddhas in the small vehicle. Can you see how that would be so, right? Because they're emphasizing enlightenment and wisdom and emptiness and not so much emphasis on compassion, which is shravakas do realize a kind of emptiness, enlightenment, but they're not emphasizing compassion. So he's saying this king style bears some resemblance to the shravakas in a small vehicle, yet that person's mind is that of a bodhisattva. Because it's for the purpose of saving all beings that he first aspires to Buddhahood for himself. So, kind of like what Richard's saying too, Muso is giving a some credence to this king way and saying it really is a bodhisattva way. It's just somebody maybe even has that karmic tendency towards wisdom rather than the emphasis on compassion. Though there is this distinction between the bodhisattvas who excel in compassion or wisdom, they aspire equally to the salvation of all beings. They are alike in that everything they do is directed toward the benefit of all beings. Even though they might be like, all you beings, go away for a while, I'm going to sit here alone and realize the way, but I'm doing it for all of you. I think that is Shakyamuni Buddha's path, right? He did the retreat thing. And we say, out of great compassion. Yes. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not as though you're going to hold on. You can't go to the point.
Yeah. I mean, this is a little bit, I think, what I was trying to say when I said the secret small print of the, of the shepherd path is that by doing that, by putting others first, you actually realize awakening. You could even say at the moment that you truly and completely wish for everyone to be free, that's a moment of forgetting yourself, right? Forgetting one's self-centered approach, and then that is the freedom from suffering, because suffering is the self-centered approach. So it doesn't say that. It sounds to ourselves, it may sound like, oh, really? Everybody first? But I think it's the it's the skillful means. It's the hidden message. Is that is one way to actually go first, is to put others first. And I think Dogen is emphasizing that. Yes, yeah, yeah.
Because otherwise, he's never there. He's just full of greed, hate, and delusion. Nobody's kind of first. But he has to have moved along enough that he can start to act on metaphor.
But we might even say, in order to even be a shepherd, he has to be somewhat far along the path, right?
Yeah,
You're not going to even want to be a shepherd.
Yeah, otherwise, you can't learn it.
Yeah, well, you can't do it if you can't do it, right? But you can. But if you want to, and you maybe feel like I don't know if I can or not, and then you just I'm just going to do it. You could say that's the wisdom.
Then you're
there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think it's all. Yeah, part of the thing, I think all of these is like, you can't fake it either. Although we might even give some credence to maybe some trying to fake it a little bit. Like, for example, I don't really feel like I can do the shepherd thing, but it sounds so great, and Dogen's promoting it, so I'd like to try. Let's just act as if I was the shepherd. And then we start doing it, and then we're faking it, and then we're realizing that actually it's real. Like I've mentioned this story before that I like, that Dogen says, brings up this example of in old China at funerals, it's a custom that if people don't feel a lot of emotion and sadness about the person who's died, it's the custom that you're supposed to force yourself to cry. You basically fake it. You find some way to cry. Maybe you think about something else that's sad. I don't really care about this person, but I should try to pretend like I'm sad. And you say, and we might think, well, that's ridiculous. That's stupid. That's being inauthentic. But Dogen actually says, this is very good. This is how practice is. You basically do fake it. And then he says, in these Chinese funerals, people do this fake crying. But then they start actually crying, and then by faking it, it actually generates their authentic feeling. And he says, practice, and we might even say bodhicitta, is like this. We kind of pretend to have this wish, I think pretend means generate it kind of in a somewhat contrived way. We practice all kinds of things in a contrived way. And then over and over again, we do it, and then it starts to become authentic. I think many things are like this.
Well, we only fake it if we want it. We only think it is something we aspire to.
Yeah. Like bowing might be a good example. Like bowing to some like Buddha on an altar, like it's totally not authentic. I don't feel anything about this. It's not me. It's not real. But then you do it for maybe like a few years, or it takes maybe a while, depending on the person. And then it starts to feel like, this is the most natural expression I could ever do. It's like, it's totally my authentic self. But like, usually, maybe almost nobody, when they first bow to a Buddha, has that feeling about it. It feels contrived. But you do it long enough, and then it feels authentic. I think a lot of things are like this. So here's another Zen, as we're getting, now this one might be, this one sounds a little different, and this, some of the things people have been bringing up are a little along this line. This is Hui Nung, the sixth ancestor. It's a kind of a Zen flavor, more like maybe the wisdom side. He says, I don't know about the wisdom, we'll see. He says, good friends, as for this vow, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. It's a section where he's talking about these four bodhisattva vows in the Platform Sutra. As for beings are numberless, I vow to save them. It isn't me who does the saving. Every being you can think of saves themselves with their own nature in their own bodies. Someone said that this morning, I think, said, don't beings actually save themselves? He's saying that's what actually happens. I make this vow, beings are numberless, I vow to save them, but it isn't really me who saves them. Every being saves themselves with their own true nature. What does this mean? The wrong views and afflictions, the ignorance and delusions in their own material bodies already possess the nature of original awakening. It is just this original awakening that saves them with right view. Once they realize the wisdom of right view, they dispel their ignorance and delusion, and each being saves themselves. So I think this is kind of a Buddha nature teaching, saying even the afflictions and greed, hate, and delusion of all beings, have the actual nature of original awakening. So all our, you know, deluded thoughts in their true nature are Buddha nature. And when they realize this with right view, the delusion drops away and they save themselves. Then you might say, well, then what's the point of this vow? But you could say understanding that and helping others understand that is actually saving beings. And I think it's true that even in these other, all these other versions of bodhicitta, when we're saying, how as a Buddha will I save beings? I need to be a Buddha to save beings. How will I actually do that? Well, if I'm a Buddha, can I just like zap people with the ray of light from my third eye and just free them? It's like, maybe, but I think it's more like we actually, as a Buddha, we help beings to see that they actually have to save themselves, or that I, even as a Buddha, can't actually save anyone. But the way I seem to save them is to help them to see that they have to let go, and maybe I help create lots of conditions for helping people to let go of whatever they're holding on to that's preventing their salvation.
You know what, a thing that's in mind that I think is beautiful that relates to that is my experience of being around, let's say, something close to enlightenment in a human being is a sense that they're seeing you in the best possible way. They're seeing the best you can be. You sense that. And the gift that you get from that, but from that development of a person, is that they show you and give you a sense of what you can be.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like they see your Buddha nature, and they're, by them seeing it, then you, that helps you to see it. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great expression. And I've heard that Suzuki Roshi is very much like that, that people would be causing all kinds of trouble and stuff, but he would really see the best in people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is the work of a bodhisattva. And some, there are teachings that say sometimes bodhisattvas kind of scold people too. It's part of the skillful means. We could say maybe generally it's what, like you say, generally it's seeing the best in people. It's maybe then they become very confident and get kind of lazy, and they need the other side. You're perfect as you are, and you could also use some improvement. Yeah. Came across this. These are maybe a little bit like, maybe a little bit the admonishing words, feeling. I don't know how you take them. This is Francis Cook in a commentary on Dogen. He's Hotsumu Joshin is in here, but this is Francis Cook's own introductory essay on arousing the thought of enlightenment. His own kind of comments. Inspired by Dogen. He says, it's easy to merely play the game formally in a discipline such as Zen. It's pleasant and rewarding to wear meditation robes, chant the sutras and mantras, bow to the Buddha, and sit in zazen. Anyone who's done much chanting knows that it gives one a feeling of euphoria. You might not think that. We can. And one may think that this good feeling is spiritual or that it indicates growth. Activities such as chanting, bowing, and sitting in zazen are not at all wasted, even when done merely formally, for even this superficial encounter with the Dharma will have some wholesome outcome at a later time. However, it must be said in the most unambiguous terms that this is not real Zen. Ooh, just, you know, doing the forms well, maybe. To follow the Dharma involves a complete reorientation of one's life in such a way that one's activities are manifestations of and are filled with a deeper meaning. If it were not otherwise, and merely sitting in zazen were enough, every frog in the pond would be enlightened, as one Zen master said. Dogen Zenji himself said that one must practice Zen with the attitude of a person trying to extinguish a fire in his hair. That is, Zen must be practiced with an attitude of single-minded urgency. I would add in, with total relaxation at the same time. It's not like a stressful urgency. Zen, therefore, must be the dominant concern in one's life, to which all other considerations are subordinated. Otherwise, the merely formal observance of Zen customs is the waste of a person's life. Thus, one turns away from ordinary things and turns to Zen as the most important thing in one's life. By turning away, I do not mean a literal cessation of ordinary activities, but rather a change in attitude towards them. This kind of turning away is a reordering of values, really, because now, instead of seeking ultimate fulfillment and goodness in pleasure, power, wealth, or a fine reputation, one seeks the Dharma as having the greatest value and the greatest potential for fulfillment. As I will explain in a later chapter, this reorientation of values is also called leaving home, shukke. But here I wish to discuss it in terms of sincere, profound determination to follow the Dharma. The traditional term for this arousing the thought of enlightenment is bodhicittodhpada, or hotsu bodhaye shin. So I think this is good. I think Sashin naturally reminds us of this, because, you know, in daily practice we are just going about the forms, we're keeping the whole thing rolling for all of us, carrying on the daily life, and Sashin, we go deeper because we're stuck here with our own mind day after day, and so we naturally start to question, what are we doing anyway? Yeah. This new determination to follow the Dharma is not a simple matter of coolly deciding that one's going to start meditating and living a more spiritual life. Decisions of this sort are very easily rescinded because we've not yet realized that the goods which most people treasure cannot really bring us happiness and contentment. This determination is, on the other hand, a kind of conversion which is very deep and moving because it signals a profound disillusionment with life as it's lived by most people. It's a realization that there's a fundamental hollowness, a basic unsatisfactoriness in the ordinary way of living our lives. But on the other hand, there's a realization, a faith, that the Dharma has the potential of restoring clarity, sanity, contentment, and supreme goodness to our everyday, ordinary lives. To have this disillusionment and to decide to follow the Dharma at all costs is what's meant by arousing the thought of enlightenment. So I found that interesting that nowhere there does he mention compassion in defining bodhicitta. It's more like this determination to become a Buddha. Later in, he talks about compassion and the importance of that also. But I think that's one thing that we might notice in the Zen style. Bodhicitta's, even Dogen's essay, seems to be more about this being a Buddha. And maybe there's this underlying faith that we just know that what Buddha means is like infinitely beneficial to all beings. So it's like we don't even bother to say it. A little dangerous maybe. But that's why I appreciate about these some of these teachings, that really bodhicitta is mainly, is the nature of bodhicitta is vast compassion, actually. And part of what that involves is becoming a Buddha, waking up, dropping off. So, how does it come to be if we can't create it, and Buddha can't just create it? It's some in this meeting, in this communion of our sentient beingness and our Buddha-ness. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you're guided by kind of the Dharma and that.
Yeah.
And it just changed in a way. Mm-hmm. But at the core of that, it's just the Dharma, just the core of that, it's the core of the truth. That this conventional life that all these beings seem to be kind of going about grasping things,
yeah,
thinking that that's what's going to do it for
mm-hmm.
us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think, to me, it's kind of like once that penetrates, just compassion is kind of a natural response because just seeing the futility of that. And
yeah.
Realizing.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you saw the futility of it kind of in your own.
Yes.
Your own case.
Yeah.
But just kind of like wow.
So much meaningless
so
stuff.
And ungraspable.
Mm.
You know, how could that
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point. Yeah. It is natural compassion. The more deeply we see the futility of so much, and you know, just like the waste of time and life energy, but even worse than that, like the you know, the immense harm that people cause each other on this earth for no valid reasons. It's, you know, horrible things that we often don't see in Santa Cruz. Maybe even sometimes in Santa Cruz, right? Out of deep delusion, the and hatred, the harm that comes, then we naturally, compassion arises. When we see how pointless it is, and we see how, and that it's all based on this basic delusion, I think that's another insight that helps generate compassion, is seeing that all the harm and suffering, really all the suffering in the world, comes from like misunderstanding and delusion, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, as you say, basically, is the root of all the problems in the world. And the more we see that, then the more we also see, wow, it really is, theoretically, it really is possible to end suffering if all beings could realize the Four Noble Truths, for example. It would be like world peace. And so in that way, it's just, well, that's a lot for all beings to deeply realize the Four Noble Truths. But we see that, I mean, I actually have that feel, that faith that, like, that's what it takes. And it actually, it's theoretically possible. It's highly unlikely that this will happen, maybe ever. But when we see how possible it is, that it's not a matter of, like, changing reality. I think that's the point. It's not like suffering is this inherent reality that can never be changed. You know, there is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It really is possible. And therefore, we can, why not put our lives into working in that direction? Well, we might say in that way that it's what creates bodhisattvas. If there weren't any suffering, there wouldn't be any bodhisattvas.
Yeah, no, so you start the act and say, well, okay, like, you know, some other time you discuss suffering, and, well, it's an essential part of the ingredient of the world, of nature, you know, that may be there if we're at school as a teacher, you know, that we couldn't do that.
But maybe part of what it's teaching is maybe mainly what it's actually teaching from a certain perspective is bodhicitta. It's encouraging bodhicitta to relieve that suffering. Now you may be saying, isn't there, even if we could potentially eliminate all suffering, wouldn't it be good to keep some around? And I don't know about that.
Well, no, I'm picturing this as a school. Graduate and then, you know, go to something else where you don't suffer, but you come here to this place is to learn from suffering.
Yeah.
That's what this school is about. You know, that's why we incarnate here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And suffering is our teacher.
Yeah. And that's why I say mainly what it's teaching from kind of today's perspective, from these kind of talks, is it's teaching us to generate bodhicitta, right? It's like, and so for this game of like Buddha Dharma in this world and the Mahayana, of course we need suffering. Yeah, that's what it's teaching us, how to learn compassion, how to learn to be free from it. And that's, like you said, I think we can see it, like that's the game, that's the dance, that's the lila, right? And, you know, in this vision you can see the potential, like, that is highly unlikely to ever happen, but this, you know, theoretical potential that there could be the complete end of suffering in all the world systems. And if that were the case, I'd have no complaints, right? I wouldn't say, well, we should. I mean, maybe just to like play with that a little bit, you could say, if it really were to end completely throughout the universe, right? Then you could say that's that spirit of lila or the dance would maybe be like, well, this is now nothing's happening. Everything's done. There's no more dharma or need for it. There's no bodhisattvas. There's no suffering. Nothing's happening. The end. And then that little spark might be like, let's play that game again. Ding! And then we'll have another round of countless eons of suffering, the dharma being discovered, the end of suffering, and yeah. Yeah, maybe repeat it exactly, the same cycle, but just for the fun of it. It's a nice perspective, actually, because especially since suffering is not about to end, we can say, let's treat it as this dance that it is, this suffering world, and appreciate these amazing gifts we can do to play in a suffering world, which I would call being a bodhisattva. Someone who's going to like play and or dance in the world of suffering, with this crazy, ridiculous vow to end it all. And then sometime, if it actually happens, then that little spark will be like, that bodhisattva dance was so fun. It was miserable, but fun and amazing. And, you know, it's not even a matter of why. It's like that spark maybe will just, it's time to do it again just because something is more interesting than nothing. Funny. Here we are in the middle of it. The dance. We offer any positive energy generated by contemplating the Bodhisattva path to all beings who could use some positive energy. We inconceivably, miraculously, through the power of our mind's intention, dedicate it and transfer it to all those beings, because everything is possible in the realm of intention. May they be free from suffering and find complete ease. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.